Greetings and mucilaginous aeroflots, my melodiously corbinaceous listeners, and welcome to this August 2016 Science News Update. I'm your host for this grotesquely maladaptive science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Let's not waste any time. First story of the night. If you had any doubt that we are now living in a science fiction universe of the future, this story will reinforce that our world is getting, well, strange. Dr. Kit Parker of Harvard, along with scientists from the University of Illinois, University of Michigan, and Stanford University, got together to create a biohybrid life form. What is that? Well, it's just what it sounds like. It is a life form that is partly artificial and partly biological. Yeah, I guess for comic geeks out there, it's a little like Cyborg from the DC universe, or, hey, the $6 billion man for you older folks, except more confusing because Parker and company did not start out with an animal and add to it or fix it. They pretty much created their own hybrid animal. If you met Parker's lab-created critter at the beach, you'd swear you saw a baby manta ray. In fact, the tiny, flexible swimmer is the product of a team of diverse scientists. They have built the most successful artificial animal yet. This technology opens the door to a much wider array of lifelike robots and artificial intelligence. One day, Parker saw his daughter entranced by watching the stingrays at the New England Aquarium in Boston. He wondered if he could engineer a muscle that can move in the same sinuous, undulating fashion. The quest for material led to creating an artificial ray with a 3D printed rubber body. Parker and company reinforced the soft rubber body with a 3D printed gold skeleton so thin that it functions like cartilage. The group adapted rat heart cells so they could respond to light by contracting. Then they were grown into a carefully arranged pattern onto the rubber and around the gold skeleton. The newly engineered animal responds to light so well that the scientists were able to guide it through an obstacle course 15 times its length using strong and weak light pulses. Parker writes, quote, "Our ray outperformed existing locomotive biohybrid systems in terms of speed, distance traveled, and durability." It was actually 6 days. "And demonstrated the potential of self-propelled, phototactically activated tissue-engineered robots," unquote. Science of this type is fundamental for engineering special-purpose creations, such as artificial worms that sniff out and eat cancer, or bionic body parts for those who have suffered accidents or diseases. Well, again, like the $6 billion man. Or imagine having little swimmers in your system that rush to the side of a medical emergency, such as a stroke. The promise of sensor-rich soft tissue frees robots to move more easily and yet not be cut off from needed input. Sensitized robots made of soft tissues could perform without the energy-sucking heaviness of metal or the artificial barriers of hard plastic exoskeletons. Thanks to this cross-disciplinary applied science, entrepreneurs in the next few years will be able to play on the border of what is life, what alive means, and frankly, what life can be. Next story. More medical engineering stuff. Will we soon be able to fix severed nerves? Maybe even severed spinal columns? Maybe, but the odds are definitely getting better. Dr. Laura Ballerini of the International School for Advanced Studies in Italy has just published a paper in the journal Science Advances this month, which suggests that carbon nanotubes just might fit the bill for helping nerves to regrow correctly and reconnect after damage. Ballerini says that, quote, "Immediately after a spinal column injury, there will be a scar that will physically block any kind of reconnection of the original fibers. But we might be able to circumvent such lesions. The idea is to induce the neurons next to the scar to make new connections and take sort of a detour to reach the target," unquote. A variety of approaches to encourage spinal neurons to regrow are being investigated because of this. One of these methods is to provide a scaffold of carbon nanotubes between the separated spinal sections to encourage the cells to connect. Ballerini says the carbon nanotubes might be the perfect scaffolding material because neurons seem to like growing on it. She states, quote, "This material has always proven to be extraordinarily good for growing neurons and improving their ability to reconnect, probably because carbon nanotubes are both tissue-friendly and conductive. They can stimulate electrical connections and electrical activity in neurons," unquote. And actually, Ballerini's team has previously shown that 2D carbon nanotube surfaces were able to support neuronal growth and synapse formation, and even electrical excitability in culture. For such materials to work in the body, though, they have to be 3D, not 2D. Luckily, Ballerini's co-author, Maurizio Di Crescenzi, a physicist at the University of Rome, had created just such a 3D nanotube mesh meant for, well, among other things, cleaning seawater after oil spills. Ballerini tested the 3D mesh for its ability to encourage neuron reconnection between two separated spinal tissue explants in culture. Normally, when placed more than 300 microns apart, explants like that can rarely reconnect on their own. Fewer than 30% of her control explant pairs reestablished electrical connectivity. But when the carbon nanotube scaffold was placed between the slices, more than 90% of the explant pairs reconnected. Without the scaffold, neurons emerging from the explants were organized into thick bundles. With the scaffold, on the other hand, the neuron grew in a more random kind of sprawling fashion, following the labyrinthine network of the nanotubes. Ballerini says, quote, "The 3D structure seems important because the density of connections will be increased, and therefore the regeneration potential and the strength of the connections with other neural cells will be improved. Essentially, the 3D mesh seems to increase the probability the neurons can find partners," unquote. A control 3D scaffold made from a biocompatible but non-conductive polymer did not improve the connections. If the carbon nanotube mesh were to be used clinically, it would need to be tolerated by the body. So Ballerini and her colleagues are now testing the material in living rats. They implanted meshes into the cortexes of adult rat brains and examined the animals 4 weeks later. Both neurons and microglia had grown into the mesh, said Ballerini, and tissue inflammation was minimal, which is good. That was an important first step to show that there was some biocompatibility with mammals. However, the really important test is putting the nanotubes into an actual injured spinal cord to see what the result is. Ballerini has yet to do this in mice, but I think that is next on her agenda. And we will see how that goes. Next up, Dolly the Sheep returns. Sort of. For a long time, geneticists wondered whether a cloned animal was really just, well, a lousy carbon copy of the original. But it took them a while to find out whether that was true or not. All right, what do I mean by a lousy copy? Well, for one, would the clone's life be shorter? Proponents of the idea that the length of the telomere determines when you die of old age have believed for a long time that clones are born automatically with shorter telomeres. Remember, telomeres are the ends of chromosomes. So, will they die at a younger age? Is that true? Well, new research published in July in the journal Nature Communications suggests that animals cloned using somatic cell nuclear transfer, SCNT, age normally, and no faster than control animals. Dr. Kevin Sinclair from the University of Nottingham and colleagues measured the metabolic, cardiac, and muscular skeletal health of 17 cloned sheep aged 7 to 9 years old, including 4 from the same cell line that gave rise to Dolly. Finding that the cloned animals showed no signs of disease related to the actual cloning process. Way back in 1996, when I was a youngling, Sir Ian Wilmot, Keith Campbell, and colleagues at the University of Scotland created Dolly by somatic cell nuclear transfer. transferring the nucleus of a female mammary gland cell to an unfertilized egg cell whose nucleus had been removed. And the result was Dolly. Dolly suffered from osteoarthritis and died at the age of 6 from progressive lung disease. 20 years after Dolly's birth, somatic cell nuclear transfer has since been used to clone more than 20 mammalian species, including human cells. Campbell died back in 2012, and Sinclair continued to study the cloned sheep. Sinclair says, quote, "We wanted to establish once and for all that cloned animals that survive and make it into old age are normal," unquote. Sinclair has now conducted a thorough health assessment of 17 cloned sheep, again, aged 7 to 9, 4 of which were generated from Dolly's tissue. The researchers measured the animals' muscular skeletal health, metabolic health, blood pressure, and compared that with a group of 5 to 6-year-old non-cloned sheep. Sinclair's team also conducted MRIs on the animals' joints to look for signs of the osteoarthritis that afflicted Dolly. Like the non-cloned animals, the cloned animals had normal blood sugar, blood pressure, and insulin sensitivity. While the team noted evidence of mild osteoarthritis in some of the cloned animals, the sheep did not show any clinical signs of the joint disease. The findings suggest that sheep cloned using somatic cell nuclear transfer appear to age normally and at no greater risk of joint disease or other chronic conditions of aging. Sinclair concludes with, quote, "This study reveals that somatic cell nuclear transfer can generate relatively healthy sheep that seem to age normally. However, we still have to keep in mind that the vast majority of nuclear transfer embryos die before reaching adulthood due to a variety of defects. Embryo and neonatal loss in generating animal clones are a real concern for us. But those that survive to adulthood, for all intents and purposes, appear perfectly normal." Unquote. Onward and upward. Next story. Well, I have to admit my gut has certainly been a cause for me to despair, but I've never even considered that anything living in my gut might be aiding in creating that despair. What do I mean by that insanity? Well, in the latest twist on how bacteria influence host biology, new research shows that gut microbes cause symptoms of quote-unquote despair. Researchers have now connected harmless gut microbes with obesity, malnutrition, heart disease, and immune function. Even more surprising, perhaps, is how these microbes influence our central nervous system. New research suggests that different microbiomes connect with different behaviors, and the changes that they cause might even promote multiple sclerosis. Dr. Patricia Casaccia of the Icahn School of Medicine in New York studies myelin repair and neuronal damage in multiple sclerosis. She and her team became curious about how antibiotics affect mouse models of MS. So they set up some experiments and began treating mice with antibiotics by force feeding. By serendipity, her group noticed behavioral differences during force feeding one specific strain of mice. Some mice began to avoid social situations and display behavior characteristics of depression. She reported her follow-up work in the journal eLife in April. Casaccia learned that antibiotics were not responsible for the depressive-like phenotype. In fact, non-obese diabetic mice developed social withdrawal and symptoms of despair following force-feeding with saline alone and no antibiotics. The turning point came when Casaccia's team performed force feeding with an antibiotic cocktail proven to deplete gut microbes. When they did that, they prevented the observed behavioral changes they'd seen before and indicated that gut microbes were necessary to bring about depressive behavior after the force feeding. To understand their observation with greater detail, Casaccia's team used sequencing to identify the populations of microbes that differed before and after saline force feeding in the mice. She found increased microbes from the Lactospirichidae and the Ruminococciae families. Her group then transfer the microbiota from animals with depressive-like behavior into germ-free mice and found that when these microbial families were abundant, the recipient mice developed depression and social avoidance. She concluded with this, quote, "We were amazed, but our experiments support that specific microbial communities have the ability to transfer depressive-like symptoms," unquote. But they were not finished there. They wanted to know how the gut bacteria could cause neuronal changes in the brain. Casaccia says, quote, "We found that the bacteria have the ability to generate metabolites that can travel through the bloodstream and reach the brain, where they tend to favor expression of depressive-like symptoms and impair the ability of oligodendrocyte progenitors to differentiate into myelin-forming cells," unquote. One of those metabolites is a chemical called cresol, which stood out for its high levels in the depressive mice. In cultured oligodendrocytes, the team found that cresol prevented myelin gene expression and differentiation of progenitors into myelin-forming cells. That result suggested a possible link between the central nervous system transcription changes, gut microbes, and the neurodegenerative disease multiple sclerosis, which is characterized by poor myelination. Remember, myelin is that fatty chemical that's needed to speed nerve signals along the length of your neuronal axons. Without myelin, nerve signals get slowed down to a dangerous level. Casaccia concludes that, quote, "It is important to study the gut-brain interactions. The intestinal microbiota have the ability to secrete neuroactive chemicals, trigger immune responses, modulate drug efficacy, or shape host physiology at distant sites. These microbe-gut-brain interactions may play a role in initiating or contributing to the pathology in many psychiatric or neurodegenerative diseases," unquote. Okay, you have probably heard the next story on your local news. What's the next story? Flossing is pointless and does not help your teeth at all. Well, let's get back to that. An investigation spearheaded by the Associated Press, of all people, has turned up a woeful lack of evidence pointing to a tangible health benefit related to the U.S. government's recommendation that Americans floss every day for maximal dental health. Seriously, we are listening to reporters' opinions on scientific medical matters? What's next? Grocery clerks giving their opinions on court cases? Seriously, I'm not the biggest fan of flossing, but this seems a bit extreme as an excuse to stop. Let's continue. August 2nd, floss-hating AP reporter Jeff Don wrote, quote, "The evidence for flossing is weak and very unreliable, of very low quality, and carries a moderate to large potential for bias," unquote. The government has issued the flossing advice since 1979 in a Surgeon General's report and its dietary guidelines for Americans, which must be supported by scientific evidence. Professional dentistry associations and thousands of dentists throughout the country have made the same recommendation for decades. But last year, when the AP asked the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the USDA to provide scientific evidence to support the recommendation, the agencies admitted that the benefits of flossing have never been adequately studied in rigorous scientific experiments. And when the government released the latest dietary guidelines for Americans this year, the flossing recommendation was conspicuously absent. Don says, quote, "Studies that looked at the health effects of flossing seem poorly designed, too small, or improperly conducted," unquote. Representatives of the American Dental Association and the American Academy of Periodontology acknowledged the weakness of the published evidence pointing to flossing benefits, but they largely stuck to their existing advice. AP President Dr. Wayne Aldridge stated, quote, "It's like building a house and not painting two sides of it. Ultimately, two sides are going to rot away quicker," unquote. Now, that statement is weak, but my justification for continuing to floss is probably just as weak. Simply put, there is no evidence at all that floss does harm, and weak evidence for flossing being helpful. That doesn't necessarily mean that flossing is ineffective. It just means that there isn't any positive evidence for flossing being effective. Flossing is a low-risk, low-cost procedure, and because clinical studies show it's effective when it's done well, we just don't have much hesitation to say go ahead and do it. It's not going to hurt. Okay, many of you are laughing at this point, thinking Campanella is at it again. Okay, here is a better reason to floss, whether we think it does any good or not. Unlike a toothbrush, which cleans the tops and outer surfaces of the teeth and gums, floss is an interdental cleaning. It's designed specifically to clean the tight spaces between the teeth and the gap between the base of the teeth and the gums. These are places that a toothbrush can't reach. And while antimicrobial mouthwash can kill bacteria that form plaque, it can't take out the stubborn tartar and the bits of food that lodge themselves into these places. So you need flossing. I mean, even if it isn't effective in the long term as a dental health agent, it helps to keep your teeth clean. Well, apparently not according to Mr. Don, but common sense must tell you to just not give it up. Next story. It may be that E. coli is on the way out. Since the 1970s, the workhorse of the molecular genetics laboratory has been E. coli. It is not only used in laboratories to express genes into proteins from every species you can imagine. There are dozens of different strains that are used, sold, and traded in the scientific community. Even giant corporations use E. coli to make commercial proteins like recombinant human insulin or the various human blood clotting factors. It's easy to grow, easy to manipulate, and generally pretty safe. It grows fast overnight, but up to 90% of experimental time may be tied up waiting for your E. coli to grow. Dr. George Church of Harvard decided he was sick of waiting for E. coli to grow for his experiments, so he started looking elsewhere for faster-growing bacteria. He says, quote, "We became obsessed with getting a faster generation time, because as speed improves, molecular biology gets easier," unquote. He reported his work in this month's issue of the journal Bioprescription. In an effort to make his experiments faster, Church recently developed Vibrio natrogens. This is a non-pathogenic free-living bacteria with the fastest generation time known, and he has developed this into a genetically tractable host organism that can be used in a laboratory. He states that, quote, "We would like to make Vibrio natrogens into an industrial organism along the lines of, but in some ways superior to E. coli," unquote. The genome of the Vibrio consists of two chromosomes, totaling about 5 million base pairs, about a half a million base pairs bigger than the genome of E. coli. It has an average generation time of 14.8 minutes, which Church's team observed at 37 degrees Celsius. And that is 2.1 times faster than E. coli. Ha! And you thought Usain Bolt was fast. Church was amazed at this. He says, quite frankly, "I'm surprised that anything can grow this fast. If you look at theoretical rates of protein synthesis, for example, this seems beyond what most of us expected," unquote. Not only does Vibrio grow fast, but unlike most industrial E. coli strains, it grows well on sucrose, that is table sugar, which is an inexpensive and environmentally friendly growth medium. Now, Church's team is looking for clues into the Vibrio's genome that can explain the organism's record-setting growth rate. Next story. If you live in Florida, watch out for rodents of unusual size. Despite the cute reference that I made to the Princess Bride there, I'm quite serious. Dr. Elizabeth Congdon of Bethune-Cookman University in Florida warned other scientists at the 53rd Annual Conference of the Animal Behavior Society on August 3rd, that capybaras, giant rodents native to South America, could become Florida's next big invasive species. She said, quote, "Capybaras have now been introduced to northern Florida. There are enough similarities to nutria to warrant a closer look at these South American newcomers," unquote. Nutria, by the way, are large invasive rodents from South America that have caused havoc in many U.S. states. They're about the size of rats, though. According to Congdon, there are currently about 50 capybara loose in northern Florida. Now, I am not a naturalist, but I am told that 50 is not yet an invasion. But these animals are the world's largest rodent, growing up to 50 kilograms or more. In the wild, the semi-aquatic animals live in social groups and forests that can be near bodies of fresh water. They're herbivores that can subsist on a wide variety of vegetation, from grass to tree bark. And they reproduce at a pretty good clip, averaging about 4 or even up to 8 pups per litter. They look like a cross between a pig and a giant rat, but some people in Florida decided they'd make good pets, until they wanted to get rid of them, and then they just let them loose in the wild. Oh yeah, great. Welcome to Florida. The loose capybaras are not automatically defined as an invasive species yet. An invasive species causes, quote, "environmental or economic harm or harm to human health," unquote. Congdon has been studying the potential for capybaras to become invasive, and they've been looking for similarities to nutria. Nutria were first imported to the U.S. in the early 1900s, and they were farmed for fur in Louisiana, but they escaped. Some were also purposely released as weed mitigators, and they quickly established themselves in Louisiana's many swamps. Efforts to control the animals, such as hunting them down, have largely failed. Congdon says, quote, "Coyotes and dogs hunt nutria, but nothing in the world, save humans, is big enough to kill a capybara. Capybara predators include anaconda, puma, and jaguar, none of which are found in North America," unquote. But Congdon doesn't advocate wildlife managers killing all the capybaras in Florida. And this has nothing to do with sentimentality or being a bleeding heart tree hugger. She has completely selfish reasons for wanting to protect the capybaras. First, they will help her research because the animals represent, quote, "an opportunity to study the process of invasion," unquote. Second, she doesn't want to go to South America to study the beasts anymore. She says, quote, "a population in Florida would be a lot easier for me to access than the one I studied in Venezuela as a graduate student. Yes, we want to keep them from spreading, but can we please not kill them all so I can study them," unquote. Last story of the night involves the birds and the bees, and plants and viruses. Well, maybe not birds so much. Viruses are sneaky little buggers. They don't eat, they don't make energy, and they can't reproduce without a host. Pretty much their only goal is to reproduce more of themselves once they find the correct host species cell. And as I said, they can be pretty sneaky about making more viral copies. Dr. John Carr of University of Cambridge reported August 11th in the journal PLOS Pathogens that some plant viruses are particularly sneaky. Instead of destroying their leafy hosts, one common plant virus takes a more backhanded approach to, well, domination. It makes infected plants more attractive to pollinators, ensuring itself a continued supply of virus-susceptible plant hosts for generations to come. Plants give off cocktails of volatile chemicals that send signals to pollinators, predators, and other plants. Carr and his team found the tomato plants infected with cucumber mosaic virus gave off a different cocktail of these chemicals than non-infected plants, and that bumblebees preferred the infected plants' brew of aerosolized phytohormones. That's a small consolation for plants that have been stunted and blemished by cucumber mosaic virus. When infected tomato plants relied on self-fertilization, they produced fewer seeds on their own than their healthy counterparts. But when bumblebees helped out, infected plant seed production matched healthy ones. Carr says, quote, "the virus benefits too. By ensuring that sick plants can still reproduce, those genes enabling susceptibility to the virus will stay in the population, and plants that are resistant to the virus can't gain the foothold that they would have if all the sick plants died too soon, unquote. The team also found that cucumber mosaic virus changes plants' chemicals by disrupting their natural defenses against disease. Normally, plants can identify when bits of foreign genetic material, like those from virus, have worked their way inside. Specialized immunoprotective enzymes snap into action and chop up the foreign invaders. Carr found that a cucumber mosaic virus protein called 2B disrupts this process by binding to the silencing molecules so that they can't do their job. That lets the virus infect the plant more easily, and it also changes the way the plant turns its genes on and off. When Carr tested a virus that didn't have the gene for the 2B protein, the infected plant didn't shift the chemicals they gave off like the plants infected with the fully functioning virus did. This is all pretty cool because it provides a link between the 2B protein and the volatile chemical production. It's a major finding that can help scientists to better understand how viruses manipulate their hosts. Carr warns that yes, this is all kind of cool, but quote, further research is needed to convincingly show that the increased pollination is really a fitness benefit for the plant. Even though the infected plants produce more seeds, those seeds could be smaller and less likely to germinate, and the shift in chemical production could lure aphids, which transmit the virus from plant to plant, just as much as bumblebees, unquote. It's interesting that this may be another example of viruses actually doing some good in the world, but we will see how the long-term research goes to answer that question. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, keep flossing. Watch out for those rodents of unusual size. Also, be careful what you step on down at the shore this summer. It could be a biohybrid swimming there. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.